Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Market moving insight and analysis. Join Jim Cramer, David Faber, and me, Carl Quintanilla, on the opening bell hour of CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk on the Street. I'm David Faber with Sarah Eisen and Mike Santoli. We are at post 9 of the New York Stock Exchange. Jim and Carl have the morning off. Let's give you a look at futures as we get ready to wrap up the trading week 30 minutes from now when we begin. I don't know what that says. I guess the NASDAQ might be down a little bit, Mike. Is that what that says?
That's exactly what it says.
All right. Yeah. All right. I got it right. Let's get
to our... How many years have you been at CNBC?
Yes, a few. Back when they barely had a ticker, I go back so far. Our roadmap does begin with tech stock volatility. Adobe shares are tumbling. Microsoft, though, record highs. Tesla and NVIDIA, those stocks, at least recently for NVIDIA, saying it's a struggle may be an overstatement, but they certainly have not been going up. The NASDAQ 100, though, pointing to its first back-to-back weekly loss since last October.
Plus, TikTok's owner ByteDance on track to surpass Meta's Facebook as the world's largest social media company by sales. And the Chamber of Commerce suing the SEC over new climate disclosure rules. A lot to unpack there.
And we're going to begin with the road ahead, in particular for what has been driving this market for quite some time, and that is namely what we call the mega cap technology companies, AI, particularly generative AI. And Mike, I'll turn to you. You know, we just mentioned, of course, NVIDIA shares, which yesterday we discussed. I mean, Jim and I years ago developed this thing called the key to this market, and it does feel like most days, it's, in some ways, it could be considered that.
It's certainly the key to what kind of market day we're going to have. NVIDIA is at a 10% correction. It doesn't look like anything on the chart. It's down 9.7% from its high. It's obviously just had this wild run. We have the whole, you know, confab next week. I don't know that anybody wants to get too negative into it. Others are saying, you know, there were parts of this market, mostly exemplified by NVIDIA, Broadcom, AMD, that just needed to cool down, no matter what else was going on, no matter how great the story was. And that's been the case for a couple of weeks. And honestly, it sort of happened on some level. The S&P 500 is down 6 of the last 9 days, but is up over that period. So there's been just a little more chop. Yesterday, the market was barely down. The S&P was like down 2/3 of a percent or something like that, maybe even less. And the equal weight was down 1%, right? So you had, when yields up, the broader mass of stocks goes down lately, and you can have this defensive move in some of the big tech stocks. Yesterday, Microsoft made an all-time high. And it's because that's what people want when things are a little bit less certain about.
So up days are bigger than down days. I mean,
this week,
this week on the NASDAQ composite, we're up on the S&P a 0.5%. NASDAQ 100 is flat. Your key to the market, I made a chart for it, actually, without talking
thanks,
to you before.
Sarah, for the top of the nine.
The Goldman Sachs in a trading note this morning, I thought, really visualized just how important and how much these stocks have outperformed. If you look at, and they did the six, right, excluding Tesla, and they go from January of 2023 until now. That's the blue line, and it just shows you what's been the key and how much they've outperformed. The middle line is the S&P, and the 494 remaining S&P 500 companies are below, which are still up, I will say, from that period.
And that is part of the bigger story, is that even though you've had this massive outperformance and added trillions of dollars in market value in six stocks, you haven't been to the complete disadvantage of the rest of the market. Actually, though, the big six there was also flattened out over the last few weeks. So there's just been a little more churn in this market. Today is a big rebalancing of all these index products.
It's including quad-wish, right?
Yes. Well, there's no more quad because they don't have single stock futures anymore. Triple.
Okay.
It's a quarterly expiration. But they do have, you know, the XLK, the big technology sector spider. They just reweight the stocks. And NVIDIA and Broadcom were being brought down in weight, Microsoft and Alphabet being brought up in weight. And the market seems to just have anticipated that. I think it's silly that we think that this is driving the action. It's a $64 billion ETF, and the tech sector is $12 trillion in market value.
Right.
Why should it matter? But it seems to matter in people's heads.
I'd just like to come back to Microsoft for a moment,
yeah,
because there is an argument to be made that it is certainly a strong reflection of enthusiasm around generative AI as anything else. And it diverged yesterday from NVIDIA, for example.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, is it tech? I'm just curious what may be behind that. If it's not, if we're not seeing that enthusiasm reflected in some of the other typical names.
I think it's a matter of there's this kind of push me, pull you, right? So Microsoft did nothing for weeks. It kind of
just, you mentioned that yesterday.
It kind of just went sideways for a little bit and, you know, has not been one of the leaders. And as I said, with a defensive tape, Microsoft is a net beneficiary. So I think we've done a lot of this, taking money from one pocket and putting it into the other when the macro has been quiet. But of course, Sarah, the macro hasn't been entirely quiet this week because of what's gone on in yields, because you got like a third straight higher than anticipated inflation number, and we're rethinking the Fed path. So I think that's also what has investors hesitating and the average stock hesitating, even if tech is driving
well,
the overall market.
Tech can only go up so much if yields are.
Well, that is
higher.
That's not exactly what I'm getting at. It's much more about.
Oh, I thought you were admitting that.
No, because it's not been true for a long time.
It's not a coincidence that this week yields have run up on the back of two hotter inflation reports, and we're now at 2-month highs.
Yes, no, that's absolutely true.
And tech
I just don't think it unusually. Yeah, that affects tech. It actually affects small caps a lot more. It affects cyclicals a lot more and consumer stuff.
By the way, Barclays wrote on this. More room to run, they say, fundamentally here. But the caution is that big tech is not a safe haven from macro de-risking. Major jumps in big tech S&P correlation occur around market sell-offs.
Yeah, and this is the idea that we've had this very, very helpful divergence, not only among sectors, but among stocks within sectors. And so the dispersion has been high. What that means is the overall index has a gentler ride. It doesn't cause a lot of volatility at the index level. When it's a macro shock, when it's really risk off, when people want to liquidate, when they want to reduce exposure across the board, then everything gets correlated and tech is not exempt. And I think that's the point Barclays is making.
Well, today Adobe share is not exempt from a downdraft as well, this after earnings, and worth hitting at this point because I'm looking, the stock could be down as much as $67 from what had been $570. You know, you're talking about a $260 billion company. You can see it there. It was the guidance perhaps that missed some of the street estimates or maybe even more so some of the buy side estimates. And then there's been this overriding fear, I guess you'd have to call it, of AI in general and the threat that it represents to Adobe's business. You remember the stock sold off pretty dramatically after the introduction of Sora, this new OpenAI program essentially that lets you create full motion video kind of things and the like. At the same time, you know, the bulls would say, listen, there's no sign as of yet that the lower cost competitors such as a Canva or even a Figma are really hurting overall growth, even though they may be taking business away. There is also a thought that perhaps they're actually increasing the total addressable market by having people get into sort of this artistic side of things more cheaply and then move up in terms of what they're willing to use and pay the subscription fees of Adobe, for example, to use them. And Mike, you know, it trades at what you might call about 23 times 23 free cash flow.
Yeah.
Which, again, those who own the stock have said, I think that's pretty cheap. It's below, you know, roughly in line with Oracle. You're talking about 40% plus margins. And there is a hope that there's going to be an acceleration in the second half. And that is what Shantanu Narayen, the company's CEO, discussed on the call last night as well.
For sure. I just think the burden of proof is a little higher now for them to prove that that AI is an enhancement, not a real challenge. They're going to have to fight that battle for a while. The pricing issues maybe were more fleeting, but does seem that that right now it does have that premium valuation. Now, it had used to trade at, you know, well above this
right.
in terms of
Free
cash flow, multiples and things like that, because it just seems such an autopilot grower, and it's just like huge addressable market, massive subscription revenue growth. And I think it's just a little bit of, you know, a rethink of exactly how immune they're going to be to some of these.
They also addressed Sora, by the way, yesterday on the call. The president saying they work with OpenAI, and he said we are obviously going to see us develop our own model, but it's all a tailwind, he said, because the more people that generate video clips, the more they need to edit that content.
Right.
So that's how they address that.
Should mention as well, $25 billion buyback over some period of time, but that's, you know, 11% or so of the current market cap, or 10% of the current market cap, so not insignificant. All right, guys, I've been following, you know, Sarah, you've been all over the place this week, but I know you watch. We've been following this TikTok story very closely, because it is fascinating, to say the least, in terms of where things stand. and where they're going. Right now, of course, and I'm sure we'll hear over the course perhaps of the day from Emily Wilkins in D.C. in terms of where things stand in the Senate, how quickly a bill to ban TikTok in the United States there will be created. Will it be part of the appropriations bill? You know, you look for Maria Cantwell and Mark Warner from Virginia, Maria Cantwell from Washington to play a key role here, as well as Lisa Monaco from the DOJ, I'm told. But again, I'll defer to my colleagues in D.C. for the latest there. What I can tell you, though, is that, you know, the Journal reporting today, and I've been bringing up any number of times, the likelihood that the Chinese are not going to say, okay, ByteDance, you can sell this. And you can sell it along with, by the way, the algorithm and the source code. Now, you can make your own algorithm, but you need at least some time to be able to copy the source code. And I went back 3.5 years. I found my notes finally after a bit of a search from 3.5 years ago when we were going through all this. Back then, it was about 10 million lines of code. Now I'm told it could be as much as 40 million lines of code. It could take a long time to conceivably to copy that code. That said, large language models apparently make it a bit easier and more possible. But the problem here is that while Steven Mnuchin may be interested in buying it, or perhaps there'll be some others out there that certainly might be, you're not going to get a chance at this point to actually do so. And so we are left with the real possibility that if the Senate acts and passes the bill, and President Biden, as he said he would, signs it, and then there's some time period and there potentially is litigation nonetheless, that this actually could disappear in the United States, as hard as it seems to imagine. Because what you're buying without the source code or access to the source code is virtually impossible. Obviously, you'd like the algorithm as well. Steven Mnuchin addressed this on Squawk Box yesterday when he was asked about, well, what do you do if you don't actually get the technology? Take a listen.
Proposals they've blocked because they were not happy about the technology transfer. And I would have to convince them and the U.S. government right. that there was a way to do this.
And that continues to be a key question. You know, there's been some talk about Bobby Kotick as well, the former, of course, CEO of Activision being involved. You know, I think the sense, frankly, that I'm hearing is, sure, if there was something to do. He was involved the last time, 3.5 years ago, along with Oracle, along with Walmart, along with Microsoft, when they all sort of were thinking about what they could do here as a block, as a ban seemed potentially possible when we got that executive order from then-President Trump to ban it. Not right now. I mean, there's nothing seemingly, you know, Mnuchin may be out there and may be able to raise some money around it, but you got to actually have a deal that you can do. And so we'll keep a close eye on the Senate and how quickly this bill moves.
For sure. And, you know, it's so interesting because I can't get away from the idea that this is all happening at a moment, arguably, when TikTok's financial growth rate
yes.
and kind of cultural sway might be peaking.
Yeah.
You know, this is the way these things tend to go.
Of course, you know, 170 million users here in the U.S., still not profitable. Again, I've talked to any number of people now who say because they're spending so much money on Project Texas, which has been all about moving all the data to the Oracle servers in Texas, that costs a lot of money. That said, there's a belief that if the Chinese were to allow the technology transfer, the thing could be worth $100 billion. I mean, you're talking about something that could be generating, just from an ad business, at least $5 billion in operating income, let's call it, over 5 years from now. Put a multiple on that and figure it out. ByteDance itself, though, extremely valuable regardless. And there doesn't seem to be quite as much pushback this time from some of the owners of ByteDance around all this because they have such dominance, not dominance, but such a significant position in the Chinese market that's added so much value overall. Mm. And by the way, remember last time there was a ban, there was a talk, it was Australia, US, New Zealand, UK, it was all the English sort of speaking TikTok that would have been involved. That doesn't appear to be the case so far this time.
There's also the users and the influencers who make a lot of money and the celebrities. And TikTok is waging a pretty active campaign getting them to call their senators right now and lobby against this. And I do wonder if we're going to continue to hear political opposition on things like First Amendment really heat up.
And of course, finally, the big beneficiary, if this were to happen, would have to be Meta.
Oh, yeah.
Without
a
doubt.
That's what President Trump says.
That's what President Trump says. And that seems to be apparent.
I mean, vertical short video. They created Reels just for that.
So. You know, the chief of staff of the president, Jeff Zients, was a board member of Meta's. Just saying. All right, coming up, the broader market versus mega caps. Canaccord's Tony Dwyer is going to share his strategy as we reach the midpoint. It's the Ides of March, right? Let's walk on the streets, right?
Let's get straight to the point. You want to grow your portfolio to fight rising costs of inflation or pay off your debt or anything standing in the way of you and financial freedom, right? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, can help. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been helping great investors like you. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just looking for tips, Yahoo Finance makes it super easy by putting all the tools and data you need in one spot. Yahoo Finance takes a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and more. You can securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. That's how Yahoo Finance gives you insights and helps you take a look at your wealth in its entirety. That big picture perspective is what great investors need. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Some new data just out moments ago. Want to hit February industrial production rising 0.1%. That was a little better than economists were expecting. They expected it to be unchanged. Capacity utilization 78.3 compared to forecast of 78.5%. All in all, I think we have seen better indications from manufacturing, which has been one of the harder parts hit of the economy lately. Things are looking up.
Things are looking up?
A little bit on manufacturing, at least.
Okay.
Not as much on the consumer after retail sales.
Let's get back to the market, see if that's looking up. We're about halfway through a month in which the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ have both hit record highs. Canaccord Genuity's chief market strategist, Tony Dwyer, joins us now. Give us his take on the road ahead. All right, so do that, Tony. I don't know if you heard the data as well, but you know, where do you stand in terms of how you see things unfolding from here over the next few months?
David, I think it's been choppy. It's going to get choppy underneath the surface. I think one of the most important things that's not talked enough about, so much of the, I ask myself when I get up in the morning all the time, where's the recession? I've been on a recession call for a while. You had an inversion of the yield curve that's been historic in terms of duration and extent. And bank lending last year shut down, you know, over the last 15 months. So how have we not gone into a recession? Most people would think that, well, you have excess savings from the pandemic, you had fiscal stimulus. But I really think it's the private credit market that has held up companies that would have ordinarily not had access to capital. So the question becomes, does that just push out a recession? Or does that eliminate one or avert one? And I think it pushes it out. So I think as we get some weaker economic data, especially on the employment front over the course of the next few months, that may put a little bit of pressure on stocks, but ultimately it should turn out to be a pretty good year when the Fed starts to really ease.
You know, Tony, we've had this conversation with you a bit in the past as well. Sarah put a chart up at the beginning of the show just showing the outperformance of those six mega cap stocks versus the rest of the market. We've talked so often over these first 2.5 months of the year about a broadening. What are your expectations in terms of that, whether it continues, and what it means for the overall performance of the S&P as your moves ahead?
Why aren't we famous for coming out and talking about the broadening and how it's great right at the peak of the broadening? So ultimately, David, is now how is what differentiates a trade versus a longer duration sustainable advance in that relative performance of small and the equal weighted S&P? And ultimately, like everything else, it comes down to earnings. I think what most people don't realize is that if you exclude the Mag 7, from 2023 earnings, they were actually down 1.2%, according to TJ Dillon at LSEG IBIS. So when you actually look at why the mega cap stocks have gotten such a big percentage of the gain over the last 15 months, it's because that's where all the earnings growth has been. Even in the current quarter, if you exclude, meaning Q1, if you exclude the Mag 7, you're still in a negative earnings growth environment. So what creates that sustainable advance versus a trade. I call it an owner versus a rental of stocks. What creates that relative performance sustainability is going to be evening out of earnings growth, and that comes to us in starting really in Q4. So that's what I think that earlier this year, maybe the market was sniffing out that's going to happen. I think it's generational. I don't think it's going to be one of those quick trades when you get that earnings performance coming in. Anytime you've had the top 10 stocks is such a big percentage of the market cap of the S&P 500, you've gone into a years of relative decline of the mega cap.
Tony, just because you just threw out the recession word and expect one, where do you see it? First of all, it's not in the market, so I think you have to defended a little bit. It's not in the economic data as well, certainly not consensus. So where do you see signs of recession?
Well, it's been wrong. And again, Sarah, that's why I brought in the idea of why hasn't it happened when it's happened every other time? The capital markets shut down, the bank lending shut down, the money supply went negative for the first time in history. There had to be a source of capital for companies to have access to money when you couldn't get it anywhere else. And for the first time in history, we have private credit bigger than the high yield market, bigger than the levered loan market at 1.7 to 1.8 trillion. So, why do I think we're going to get it now? Number one, we've been in a recession in the manufacturing sector. What most people don't know, Sarah, is that there's something called the initiation survey rate. We had 176,000 job reduction in the estimate in the last 2 months at the latest payroll data. Prior to the pandemic, if I reached out to CNBC and said, how many people are you hiring? How many people are you firing? Historically, 70% of companies would respond quickly enough to put it in the initial number. It's called the initiation survey rate. Post-pandemic, that's dropped to 40. In January of this year, according to the BLS, it was 27%. So we have widely incomplete data. The vast majority of the time in the last year, it's been negatively revised. I mean, how many people like me came on TV a month ago and said the Fed may not even cut rates because employment was up 335,000 jobs, only to be revised significantly lower. So I think it's going to come from a weaker employment picture. The longer that the Fed stays higher, the higher for longer, the steeper the debt cliff comes when it's time to roll it over.
All right, Tony, we got to leave it there. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us this morning.
You too. Thanks, guys.
When we come back, hear what Palantir CEO Alex Karp told me about short sellers this week. He's not pulling punches. More Squawk on the Street when we come right back.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable, high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
Here at the Big Board, Madison Square Garden Entertainment, celebrating the NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament. Big East Tournament begins at the NASDAQ Pernod Ricard North America, celebrating, what else, St. Patrick's Day, which is this Sunday.
Yes.
Very celebratory. We saw big inflows, actually, this week, Mike, into equity funds and crypto funds.
We did. Almost everything, actually.
Michael Hart, out of Bank of America, called it a little bubbly.
It was a buy it all, yeah. And it does contribute to this idea that we have had sentiment get a little bit elevated, and that you could see that kind of across the board. And this somewhat explains this little break in stride we've had in the momentum leaders. The momentum basket is underperforming this week. NVIDIA indicated lower, and now it is lower at the open. And the 10-year Treasury yield crossed about 4.3. It's at 4.31 right now. So sell-off in bonds, hotter than expected inflation, bracing for what the Fed might say next week, and really an occasion for a reset a little bit in the market, which has had an incredible run. And it's been mostly based on soft landing, earnings growing higher, and the Fed looking for a chance to ease all at once.
It's been hard to fight the rally. The short sellers are like in hibernation, right, on this? And this week I got to speak with Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, about short sellers. His stock is up 200% in the last 12 months. He feels very good about the fact that they are not doing well betting on his stock. Here's what he said.
I love burning the short sellers. Like, almost nothing makes a human happier than taking the lines of cocaine and away from these short sellers who, like, are going short on a truly great American company, not just ours, but just love pulling down great American companies so that they can pay for their Coke. And the best thing that could happen to them is we will lead their Coke dealers to their homes after they can't pay their bills. And that's like one of my...
Surely all short sellers...
Yeah, well, you know, go ahead. Habits. Do your thing. We'll do our thing.
Tell us how you really feel.
Must have watched The Wolf of Wall Street a lot of times or something.
You know what?
I don't know, man. Coke sniffing short sellers? Really?
I think he was part serious, part joking, but the truth is that had a lot of pent-up anger there for short sellers. We will lead them. We will lead them to their homes.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think, I mean, Mike,
dealers,
we, you know, listen, there are short sellers who do an enormous amount of work that is not done oftentimes by others, that have very strong cases to be made sometimes, whether it's underlying fundamentals or unearthing things that we're unaware of. That said, there also are times when, of course, they do engage in perhaps behavior that is seen as somewhat unethical.
But for some reason, short sellers get a lot of grief when they are out there talking their book, and when we don't actually apply the same thing to people saying, we love this stock, it's going higher, it's going to be great in 5 years. I kind of don't understand why he's so focused on it. It's 5% of the shares are short at Palantir right now. It's not as if this is a massively crowded short. History says that companies that scapegoat shorts and spend a lot of time thinking and talking about them underperform over the long term. You're better off ignoring it and showing it with the results. Combativeness is great. You want your company to do well. You want them to lose money if they're short.
I think he's a founder, first
of
all.
Yeah, of course.
And I think there were a lot of doubters when Palantir went public.
Absolutely.
What do they do? It's so secretive. How is this going to work?
Can they have a commercial business as opposed to just DOD?
And when he's sitting on, first of all, he's proven that they can. Their last quarter commercial accounts rose 55%, and it's been a big growth story for them. What they're doing on the battlefield and changing warfare through AI. And so he's sitting on this kind of game-changing technology wondering, what the heck are these people doing shorting my stock early?
All true,
early
but I kind of agree with Mike in the sense that they're in his head, which is weird, because the company's
stock
performing.
The stock also went from 9 to 35 in the first 2 months it was public, and people said, what is this? There's not a lot there. And so, you know, and so it did have its crash, along with all the other class of 2020, you know, tech startups, and it went down to 6. Now it's back up into 23.
Still, I guess he bears the scars.
I think he probably just says what a lot of CEOs think, which is, we don't want you betting against our company.
Sure, that's fair.
We're a great American company.
Yeah. Distraction more than anything else. Just deliver. Unless lies are being spread, in which case you need to combat it. You want to talk Ulta at all?
We talked
Adobe at the top of the hour. Of course, that stock is down sharply. Ulta shares pairing losses, but still down some 7%, Sarah, after reporting numbers.
It was a pretty good beat, at least on the bottom and top line, driven by better comps and better margins. It's the guidance, like Adobe, that came in a little bit short of what Wall Street was expecting. And there were high hopes for this stock. It was already outperforming about 16% year to date so far. Look, their warning of slower growth ahead from the CEO, Dave Kimball, he said, in 2024, the category will remain healthy, but the growth will moderate to the mid-single-digit range, barring any major economic event. So investors are really used to strong growth from this company, and, you know, the analysts are stepping out and defending it this morning. Simeon Siegel, for instance, of BMO, says that he thinks the guidance will prove conservative. And that they will continue to outperform. One thing to look at, everyone looks at on this one, is the ticket versus the average selling price. Tickets were down. The average ticket was down for the fourth quarter in a row. But average selling prices did partially offset that. The price increases are still happening. They're still benefiting. They're contributing less than they have been in previous quarters. And the only other thing I would say is that, you know, that if TikTok does get banned in the U.S., it's companies like this that will feel an impact as well. They went to great lengths to highlight that they reached 1 million followers on TikTok.
Yeah.
Beauty is a major driver
Absolutely.
Of trends, activity, and buying.
The amount
TikTok.
Of economic activity that takes place as a result of TikTok is not insubstantial. I mean, just think about the influencers and how marketing has changed, Sarah, as you well know. Advertising agencies now, they're actually finding the right influencer for the brand. That's kind of one of their key value adds that they do now.
And also, you know, generative AI, they're all experimenting with AI. One of the things they're doing is they're able to scrape, you know, TikTok and all of these social media platforms to very quickly come up with the trend. What's trending? Lip oil, for instance, really big right now. I learned that from TikTok.
You did, yeah. Well, listen,
didn't we all? I mean, I was going to say that the other interesting thing about Ulta is it seems like for every specialty retail category, there's like the one anointed great growth story that keeps delivering. Ulta in beauty, obviously, Williams-Sonoma, for home furnishings and Dick's Sporting Goods, obviously in the athletic area. And all of them massively outperformed the retail index over the last couple of years in a very similar way. So this is a little bit of a give back. Ulta's not a super expensive stock. So kind of an interesting moment. You wonder if the little bit of the TikTok stuff and the higher potential marketing costs is in investors' heads for the moment.
We got the mega cap got names all down at the very beginning here, Mike. Tesla shares showing a little signs of life after what's been another rough week.
Yes, and that's been the question as to, you know, not only will the kind of downgrades and bad news and lowered earnings estimates start to abate, but will the stock, you know, kind of rise on some bad news at some point? So it is perking up. It is super oversold. It is a massive laggard. And I do think one of the effects that you have seen recently is when NVIDIA is down, the laggard members of the mega cap basket have gotten a bid. So obviously a long road, you know, up from here. So, you know, it's almost as if the less fundamental and research news on Tesla, the better. Just let the thing settle out.
Wells Fargo with the note yesterday saying it's a growth story without growth.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was the other day. And you know, there's a lot of negative research this week on Tesla.
There's been a drumbeat. I mean, I think it's been hard to avoid having to cut your estimates, you know, given what's going on with pricing and volumes recently. But, you know, it's an interesting sort of test case. People say, what would happen if NVIDIA really cracked and it, you know, gave up a huge amount of gains? Well, I mean, Tesla is down $700 billion from its peak market cap. I mean, it's, you know, it's over a year or whatever, but it didn't exactly upend the entire market. So, I mean, there are ways to kind of bleed away some of the premium without necessarily, you know, it spreading to other parts of the market.
Yes, we pointed out a number of times, it's just a bit above a half a trillion dollar market value. Nothing. Not insignificant, but below that of J.P. Morgan, for example, now, and certainly, and I believe Broadcom as well, I believe, has also exceeded it.
Yes.
$576 billion. So it just gives a sense.
U.S. Steel?
Yeah, sure. Let's do a little something on U.S. Steel, shall we?
I was wondering about it.
It's been a rough, you have. It was been a rough week for shares of U.S. Steel. Of course, this was a company that I followed from some time from an M&A perspective, as our viewers may remember, as there were any number of bidders for the company, culminating in what was a $55 all-cash deal with Japan's Nippon Steel. And that was a number that was even far above the hopes of many shareholders. But it has not been a good week, and that was led off by a number of stories that indicated that the administration would essentially come out against the deal, if you want to call it that. And President Biden did more or less that with comments about saying that he wants U.S. Steel to remain in domestic hands. What is that going to mean for the future of the deal, of course, has been a key question for many, and that continues to be a question. You still have the contract with Nippon Steel. How you would block the deal? Well, perhaps on CFIUS grounds, even though many have pointed out it's not clear that it really represents a national security risk in any real way. And what really did play an important role here, of course, was the unions. And the union leader of the United Steelworkers, David McCall, who has some sway, as you might expect, with this administration, particularly with Joe Biden, a man from Pennsylvania who's already walked a picket line over this last number of months when he did so with the UAW when they were on strike. And he got a good audience, right? So what now continues to be sort of the question. There's a shareholder vote in April. U.S. Steel shareholders expected to approve the deal. It's a $560 million break fee. Do you try to get CFIUS? Do you see what happens? Do you wait and see whether there's a change in administration come later this year or into next year? Those are any number of questions. And then there's the role that Cleveland-Cliffs has played here, and it's outspoken CEO Lorenzo Gonzalez. I had a chance to speak to him, as many people seem to be lately, this morning. He did go on the record with me. And listen, he points strictly to the deal that he signed with the unions and the fact that the importance of the unions was undersold. He, as he often does, was happy to name names, saying that the two bankers who sort of led the process for U.S. Steel were really at fault here as well. Talking about Grabos and Hoffrecht, of course, Dan Grabos at Barclays and Brian Hoffrecht at Goldman Sachs, saying they just didn't get it. you know, they believe the workers need to eat, and so you're going to figure out a deal with Nippon. Well, that has not been the case. Now, for its part, Nippon says that it is open to and wants to negotiate what would be a very attractive deal for the unions. Lorenzo said to me, no, you know, they're never going to get that done. Hell will freeze over before, in fact, anything like that happens, given all the different assets that will come from the unions. And so the question then, all right, does Cleveland-Cliffs come back in some fashion and bid? Do they simply wait for the deal to fall apart under its own weight and then try to come back at a far lower price than the 54 cash and stock that they previously offered? We'll see. He did say, tell me, and I thought this was interesting, guys, that they had tried in previous weeks through Citi, which is Nippon Steel's advisor, to get Nippon Steel to talk to Cleveland-Cliffs, because Nippon Steel began this with wanting Big River. That is the plant in Arkansas that's the key. They were willing to pay as much as $9.3 billion just for that. And so Gonsalves was like, listen, we'll buy a lot of the other assets. Let's have a conversation about that once you close the deal. No such conversation took place, and hence Dave McCall got involved, President Biden got involved, and here we are, wondering what really is going to happen here. By the way, the Japanese Prime Minister due in the U.S. in early April. Could be a somewhat difficult conversation between Biden and the Japanese Prime Minister.
There's just a slight bit of irony in the sense that there's this objection to a Japanese owner. Maybe the union wouldn't be happy with it when you consider that Japanese companies just agreed to the biggest wage increases for Japanese workers, above 5%, biggest one in 33 years. So it's sort of this moment when there's an acknowledgement that workers kind of can demand and deserve a higher share.
Yeah.
And it's not automatic that it's going to be hostile to, you know, giving the workers their share.
Yeah, I mean, the underlying assumption that perhaps was wrong was that the union didn't really have much of a say here. Clearly that is different because they had a very important call to make and they made it.
Also unlikely for that Cleveland-Cliffs would team up with the Steelworkers Union to lobby against this deal, which is what happened.
Absolutely.
In this case.
They are obviously have been a union shop and have a good relationship, does he, with his unions as well. So, you know, you could end up, though, where U.S. Steel just remains a public company. And is that good for the unions or not? Unclear.
Yeah. Can I do a Sarah report now?
Please.
After the
Faber report? What you want
to
call
it? It'll be half as long. Eisen report. No, I just thought it was interesting, this story about the Chamber of Commerce today now suing the SEC over these new climate disclosure rules. So this has been a long saga. It went from proposal to rule. It got watered down a little bit in the process, but it did just get finalized recently, and that is that big companies, according to the SEC rules now, are going to have to disclose emissions and other climate-related metrics. While the Chamber of Commerce, which is the biggest business lobby, is suing, they've joined with 10 other Republican attorney generals across states against this rule. It has proved a very contentious rule. And you know who someone who is not a fan of this rule is? Ken Griffin, who I got to speak with this week in Florida at the FIA summit. We specifically discussed, first of all, we talked about Gary Gensler, who he made a joke was his bestie on Snapchat. And then I asked about this climate rule and what he had to say about it. Listen.
How well do you think the average company in the United States can actually measure that?
Not too well.
Okay. So are we doing this for the plaintiff's lawyers or are we doing this for investors? I'm just kind of curious.
Investors? The environment? But shouldn't they be able to measure it? Wouldn't that be responsible?
How about this? If you're going to go on a strategy to reduce carbon, how about thinking about addressing that at the source, which would be, for example, a carbon tax? There you'll actually get changes in behavior. Here, what you're going to get is a multi-billion dollar bill that corporate America is going to have to pay. You're going to see fewer companies go public, which means less investment opportunities for American households and American retirees. With fewer companies going public, you're going to see less venture capital formation. Well, with that, you're going to see less R&D in America. VC-backed firms that are public account for about two-thirds of all America's research and development budget.
So you see this as political?
This is 150% political.
Ken Griffin, really connecting the dots there in terms of what it could mean for Americans, what it could mean for companies going, the unintended consequences, which he has been railing against on this SEC and its bevy of proposals. By the way, he also went after, for the first time really, the Biden administration's new rule to ban exports of natural gas, pause exports of natural gas, on the similar theme. Okay, they're trying to do something good for the environment, but in fact, in reality, what they're telling, according to Griffin, allies is, okay, just continue with coal. Because natural gas is
you know,
a lot
listen,
cleaner.
What you will hear oftentimes is price on carbon is really the most effective way to actually mitigate. And until we get that, we're going to be dealing with a lot of different things that don't necessarily get to the source of the problem.
I mean, hasn't Powell resisted this idea that the Fed should somehow also be a little bit of a carbon cop, you know, when it comes to banks and what they're doing and lending? So I think there is a little bit of a soft backlash here.
It's not in his mandate. Powell,
what's that?
Good luck putting climate into any of the Fed
every
does,
time he's asked, he's like,
so
no, thank
backlash.
You.
Yeah.
I know.
No.
All right, I'm going to do the bond report, unless you want to do it, Sarah.
Let's tag team.
Okay, good. Well, let's check
higher
out
yields.
How our Treasury is doing this morning. You ask, well, we'll show you. There they are. Sarah said it.
We got one, two hotter inflation reports this week into a Fed meeting next week. Will they change the dots? That's the big question. They predicted 3 this year last time. Could they take it down to 2?
All right, we'll be right back.
Amazon has been expanding into a new corner of e-commerce, social media shopping. The company may stand to benefit if TikTok does indeed get banned. Our Kate Rooney joins us to explain. What are they doing here, Kate?
Hey, Sarah. Yeah, so Amazon might not be the first name that comes to mind around social media shopping, but after a partnership blitz last year, Amazon is now embedded in the biggest social apps. A lot of this happened within 6 months last year. Amazon teamed up with Pinterest in April of 2023, then Facebook, Instagram, and Snapchat all in November. The agreements put Amazon products into social feeds and then lets users link Amazon accounts to then make purchases. This is for both core Amazon products and some of the third-party sellers out there. And then amid those deals last year, the e-commerce giant was also taking a page from Instagram and TikTok for its own mobile app. It launched Inspire in 2023. So this lives within the Amazon app. It looks a lot like Reels. And these are actually Amazon products. So they're being promoted by influencers. They've been partnering with content creators since 2017. And part of this, guys, is defensive. So scrolling and shopping, as you guys were talking about with Ulta and TikTok, it's a bigger slice of e-commerce that Amazon does not want to miss out on. Insider Intelligence estimates social e-commerce will grow into a $100 billion market next year, up from $67 billion last year. Younger generations are driving it. A quarter of social shoppers are between 25 and 34. That's according to eMarketer. Instagram tends to bring the most purchasing power. TikTok, though, not far behind. It's pretty much tied with YouTube. I talked to Mark Mahaney over at Evercore about the potential impact on Amazon if TikTok does get banned. He told me, quote, to the extent TikTok is taken off the table, it could be an incremental positive and means more opportunity for Amazon because of some of these shopping partnerships. Mahaney points out that the social strategy is driving both sales and advertising for Amazon. Guys, back over to you.
Well, that's what I was wondering about is the sales piece, Kate, because I feel like we've been hearing about social shopping for at least a decade. And while influencers have made a lot of money, obviously, and you spot the trends, I feel like the shopping has been less successful. Nobody has fully nailed it. What does the trends look like on the sales?
So it's interesting, Sarah. It's still sort of that impulse purchase, right, that you're seeing, you're getting inspired to buy something that you might not need. It's not the core, you know, toilet paper and things that you're trying to get immediately delivered from Amazon. So it's still incremental. It's still kind of the impulse side of things and that discretionary spending. And Amazon, this is defensive. They don't want to miss out on that incremental sales. But right now, it is sort of in that category versus being your core shopping where you're looking, you know, for diapers, for toilet paper. So it hasn't quite gotten there. But in terms of the growth potential, it's really the younger consumer behavior that they're going after here.
Kate, thank you. Kate Rooney. Well, coming up right here, an EV winter. Is it one for Tesla, Lucid, Rivian, other automakers? We're going to discuss that with Ford CEO or former CEO Mark Fields. Keep it here.
You've been listening to the opening bell on CNBC's Squawk on the Street.
All opinions expressed by the Squawk on the Street participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, or their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information Squawk on the Street participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and/or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Squawk on the Street disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Squawk on the Street disclaimer.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.